NBA, the Bucks beat the Bulls last night. Bucks play in Washington tonight. The Bulls are off. NHL, Blackhawks over Nashville 3-2. The forecast now from the National Weather Service. Sunny and cold for the morning. Cloudy, maybe an inch of snow this afternoon. High of 19. Right now, 0, Kenosha and Racine. 8 below for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. 14 below, wind chill for much of the area. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show with a veterinarian by the name of Nick Trout. He is a staff surgeon at the Angel Animal Medical Center close to Boston, Massachusetts. And you perhaps know the name of Dr. Trout from a previous New York Times bestseller called Tell Me Where It Hurts. His latest book is called Ever by My Side, a memoir in 8 pets. We have the word axe crossed out and pets in its place. And in this very personal, beautiful book, Dr. Trout talks about, first of all, a childhood in which he grew up with pets of one kind or another, and eventually came to see his destiny as becoming a veterinarian. He grew up in England, and it's also the story of transplanting himself to the United States, far away from his beloved parents and the country that had been home for a long time. And it is about the new life which he built for himself here with a wife and child, and the pets which have been a part of his own personal life. It's a really lovely book written with great care and sensitivity. And I'm very excited to have Dr. Nick Trout on the phone with me to talk about this book, which is published by Broadway, again called Ever by My Side, a memoir in 8 pets. Dr. Nick Trout, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks, Greg. Thanks for those kind words as well.
I'm not sure you give us much of a hint in your book as to what sort of a writer you have been all your life. I mean, if, for instance, growing up, if writing was something that was one of your gifts that ever got much attention from you. I mean, is writing a fairly, serious writing a fairly new exploit for you?
Yes, you could say that. I was speaking at a literary meeting some years ago, and I was invited to reveal something unusual about my past. And what I told the group was that I actually stopped my formal education in English at the age of 16 by virtue of school systems and college and what have you. And so, no, I had no training or natural proclivity toward writing in any way. And it was just something that has come to me over really the last decade or so. Not least because of the kind of material my profession sends my way. I think all writers are looking for a hint of mystery, intrigue, love, loss, hope, fear, highs and lows. And I'm fortunate in my day job to get that kind of material walking through the hospital doors or continuously. So, you know, the, it was really just saying, you know, perhaps I should write a little bit about this, and that's how things unfolded.
Mm. What does writing do for you besides the most sort of obvious pleasures of writing books that a lot of people purchase and so on? But aside from that, what does this sort of mean to you on a more personal level?
Well, I think, you know, when I'm in a examination room or I'm talking to an owner face-to-face or over the phone or whatever, and those moments in the operating room where there's so much more drama, I guess what I'm trying to do is to capture the various aspects of the relationships we have with our animals. I mean, I get to do what I do because of how much a person loves an animal in their life. They are there for me to restore that love, to keep this animal with them for as long as possible. And the part of the thrill for me is trying to put that emotion onto a page, to try and capture it, to see if I can find a way that, you know, someone who reads this will say, exactly, that's exactly how I feel, or I've been there, I know the difficulty of that decision, and what motivated me to do that for my animal. And that's part of the pleasure, you know, I get when someone will tell me, I think you got it exactly right. One of my favorite letters I had was from I think it was an 84-year-old veterinarian who was a graduate of Cornell, I think, back in the 50s, and obviously a very wise gentleman. And he just said how much he enjoyed it, my first book, because he'd done everything that I'd done. He'd been in all of those situations, and it was wonderful for him to relive it. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to get a better compliment than that.
Hmm. Because this is such a personal book, did you go, for instance, to your parents or to your wife?
Absolutely.
And essentially ask permission to do this?
I did. And it is, I mean, I'm naturally a fairly shy person. And, you know, you are pouring your heart out and laying yourself bare at times emotionally. But, you know, this was, you know, this was important for me to capture, you know, those animals in my lives, those times when I felt like I've gleaned something very important, meaningful, and lasting from something, in an, you know, involving an animal. And I actually, my father was kind enough to sort of just go off over a period of a couple of months and try to document some of, you know, what we shared, particularly when I was a child, with the dogs in my past. And so he put his spin on that, so I could sort of take part of what he'd written down and say, okay, I see where you're coming from. This was what I was thinking. And you know, we would come to a sort of conclusion there. And it was nice to have that open banter about, you know, a subject, you know, from time to time that has been unsaid.
Hmm. I'm impressed, too, because I mean, when I stop and think about if I were to, it's not likely it's ever going to happen, but if I was ever moved to write a memoir, my family always had pets, but I feel like my memories of our pets is basically so hazy that I couldn't begin to tell the kind of stories that that you tell in your book. I mean, maybe one or two if I really sat down and thought about it. But I'm impressed by the acuity of with which you remember some of these interesting stories. I suspect your father probably helped to fill
Absolutely.
In some of those blanks.
Yes, and then, you know, other family members and, as you said, my wife as well. But I think, you know, one of the things I talk about in the very beginning of the book, in the author's note, is the fact that I'm likening what pets can do for us to bumper stickers on the back of a car, in a way. You know, we've all sat in traffic and the vehicle in front is peppered with bumper stickers. And by looking at these various phrases or pictures or whatever, we get a pretty good idea of who's driving. And what I was trying to do was to say all of the animals in my life have, in one way or the other, contributed their own little bumper sticker, something that has stayed with me, that has made a mark, and this is my attempt to show them off. And so it wasn't, in the end, it wasn't hard to think, oh, wow, yeah, that was something that has stayed with me. And again, as you say, with the help of the family, you can pull those things together. And I think also, you know, there's been some big emotional upheavals in my life, and so you're perhaps a little more tuned in to what's going on. And those times when animals have really, you know, done something that has stayed with you and resonated, you know, you're not going to forget those things.
Hmm. On the cover of the book, we see the word memoir, but I remember in the author's note, you say at one point that this book is maybe less memoir than discerning retrospective.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could explain what that distinction in your mind is all about.
Well, I think, you know, the phrase memoir has been very sort of critically appraised in terms of, you know, exactly what happened in your life that you're documenting. And obviously, you know, if we were to write about everything in our lives, it would be a fairly dull diatribe of events that weren't that stimulating. And so in terms of discerning, I've tried to focus on those moments that were primarily related to my progression into veterinary medicine and the animals around me, as opposed to every event that was perhaps, to my way of thinking, memorable, but not necessarily sticking with that theme. And so I've tried, you know, no one wants to hear about how I was run over by a car when I was 5 years old and somehow managed not to get in any way injured, or crashed a motorbike, because those are, yes, they may be interesting, but they're not, you know, driving this story forward in the context of what I want to convey.
Right. So we don't learn about your first girlfriend, for instance.
Exactly.
Or any of your track meets. I mean,
no.
That is for another book you might write someday.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you're trying to write a memoir, you know, I'm not like a huge celebrity on which every moment in my life is being, you know, scrutinized and criticized and monitored. You know, this is something I'm trying to write to get across, you know, the relationships that we have with the animals in our lives and how they have become increasingly special to us. And, you know, in the past books that I've written, I've talked about other people's animals. And, you know, that's, to some extent, a professional relationship. And so here was a chance for me to talk about personal relationships, the animals that I've got to know far more, you know, clearly and closely over the years.
We're speaking with Dr. Nick Trout, and we're talking about his latest book, which is called Ever by My Side, A Memoir in 8 Pets. It's so intriguing that the very first dog we hear about is not one of your own, but the dog that was owned by one of your grandmothers, and it was a dog with which you had not a positive relationship really at all.
No.
Tell our listeners about Marty.
Yeah.
I just hasten to add, it's in some ways a very unpromising start to your relationship to dogs, and kind of an unpromising or surprising start to your memoir.
Well, it's the truth. This was when I was a very young boy, we did not have any pets, dogs, cats, otherwise, of our own, and so the first animals that I got to know were the dogs of my grandmother's. My father's mother had a wonderful, cuddly, extraordinarily tolerant, bomb-proof Dalmatian called Cleo. And the yin to Cleo's yang was Marty, who was a ornery young male toy poodle who would really tolerate no small hands or petting from children unless he was going to use your extremities as a chew toy. And, you know, it was this diversity in these two animals that that I found so confusing as a little boy, because I couldn't understand what would prompt my grandmother, who was Marty's owner, to love a dog as much in the same way as I could love this dog Cleo. I mean, Marty was this dog that was considered a pet that you could not pet because it was, the dog was off limits. It was too dangerous to go near. And on one occasion, my grandmother, who I viewed to be at least 200 years old and completely incapable of any kind of physical activity, leapt into a roiling Irish sea to save Marty when he got swept out to sea on a beach trip. And this was completely unfathomable to me, that an elderly woman would risk her life to save this dog that was, you know, sent by the devil to instill fear in young children. And yet, that recollection, which I can still see vividly to this day, was a very important turning point for me because of the realization that it's a very personal relationship that individuals have with their animals. What may look strange to me may work perfectly for them. And that's part of the gift of having a pet in your life. That's why we see so many different dog breeds or cat breeds, you know, or someone chooses a gerbil versus a ferret. And, you know, that's what's so wonderful about having animals with us.
Mm. That same first chapter of the book also includes a very interesting little story about you and three of your neighborhood friends, and one of you coming across a small white bag with something wriggling inside of it, and it happened to be four kittens. This is obviously kind of an interesting, important experience for you as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was, you know, as I allude to, you know, I grew up in an era in the 60s in England whereby, you know, kids went out at the beginning of the day and they met up with friends and, you know, they weren't allowed home until they were clinically dehydrated or had lost sufficient blood that they required surgical intervention, you know, that something serious had happened to them. You know, it was unscheduled entertainment outside. And as kids came across what had been obviously a discarded bag of kittens, and I think there's that innate childhood desire to do something positive, to be a hero, for want of a better word, to do something for an innocent creature. And my pals and I were lucky enough to track down a lady who, you know, was someone who looked after and rescued abandoned animals, particularly cats, and she was happy enough to take them in. And despite my age and incredible naivety that, you know, you just had a cat and it thrived on milk and canned tuna, this lady was good enough to try to nurse these animals back to health. And yet that act, you know, which we walked away from, we basically handed over these cats. It wasn't like we did anything much ourselves, but we felt like our intervention had saved lives. And that was the kicker, really, that made you go, boy, that feels good. And it, you know, it happens all the time. People do have a great feeling when they do something positive for an animal or an individual who you know, requires their help.
You write, "That particular afternoon, we walked away from the cat lady's house with a certain swagger, heads held high and big smiles all around, because for the first time in our lives, albeit with a quarter of abandoned kittens, and in spite of their uncertain future, we believed we got to right a wrong, just like our idols on the big screen." You do mention at one point that as you look back, as far as you can tell, this woman was not what we call an animal hoarder. And, of course, we hear more and more about that, about people who either because of, you know, perhaps some kind of mental illness that has them acting out in this way, or sometimes for perfectly innocent reasons that in which they're just overtaken by some good deeds that right. sort of pile on top of each other. We hear more and more about people whose homes are filled with animals that they cannot possibly properly care for.
Right.
This seems not to have been that kind of cat lady.
Well, that was where I was sort of looking back and trying to, you know, because I work for the MSPCA, the Massachusetts Society of Prevention and Cruelty to Animals, I've actually spoken with some of the animal control officers about, you know, the fact, you know, what constitutes animal hoarding, and I've seen videos and descriptions of what was found in these cases. And so I used that as a guide to what I recalled of this facility. And as I describe, you know, there were clean cages, there was actual, you know, fresh newspaper down, there was actual facilities for housing various animals. This was not random. It was not just loose animals running around, soiling the interior of a house or anything like that. And so, although, you know, no one earns the reputation of a label, a moniker, cat lady for no reason, I still believed that it was for a good reason. It was for trying to help cats in a positive way rather than some sort of mental health disorder. Mm.
The second chapter of the book is where you finally are able to have a pet of your own, or at least there is a pet in the home, although it turns out to be a dog that, in a sense, belongs much more to your father than to you. I mean, the two of them enjoy this amazing rapport, your dad and this dog named Patch. But my word, it's a long, hard road trying to persuade your mother to permit the purchase of a pet. You write at one point, "To be honest, I didn't really care whether it was a dog or a cat. Either was as ridiculous as a rhinoceros to my mother." What was it about this notion that to which she was so resistant? What's the reason?
I mean, I think it was, you know, goes back to sort of some of the personal issues that my family was going through. My parents were poor. They didn't have a lot of money. My father was bouncing from one job to another. I think my mother has always been the more sensible person in the family with regard to money and responsibility. And she just felt that we weren't ready for an animal and that we couldn't look after it properly. We couldn't afford its health care. And she was just being the voice of reason. And yet my father, as is his way, you know, he wears his heart on his sleeve and he's very emotional when it comes to animals, and that's what he wanted. And ultimately, he conspired with his mother to get this dog without my mother's knowledge. He just turned up with this dog. And he told me when I was inviting him to write about this, he said, you know, I don't think my mother, after being married for, 47 years now, has still not forgiven him. She, as I describe, was unable to avoid the appeal of this dog and was caught on many occasions softening, you know, her facade of cold indifference to the animal. Hmm. And she has since then, obviously, we've gone on to have many dogs since, but there was always that sort of sense that this created a significant rift in their relationship because he'd done something against her will, and the very fact that he says that he still doesn't feel completely forgiven, really sort of smacks home as to how much of an impact that decision to get a dog had.
Right. And you write, she had never wanted a dog, and on some level, having Patch around was always a reminder of a moment of weakness in her marriage.
Right.
One of my favorite passages in this chapter is when you describe, really step by step, quite methodically, a wonderful little exchange between you and your dad and Patch back when he was a puppy. You call this my first and best lesson in animal handling.
Yeah.
Tell our listeners about that.
Well, I was just, you know, as a kid, I was, you know, quickly aware of the fact that German Shepherds have this tendency to glue to a specific individual in their pack, in their family. And my father was it, and it wasn't me. And I wanted to sort of see what some of this magic was about. And while they were doing some of their training exercises in the backyard, he did this methodical massage almost of you know, stroking individual parts of the dog's body, you know, the head and the ears and the back and the tail. And it was, you know, the dog was in heaven and mesmerized, but no more so than when he scratched under the dog's armpits. And I just couldn't fathom this. This seems such a strange and unusual thing to do. No one ever does that. And as my father explained, and also watching the response in the dog that just melted and sort of collapsed with joy and ecstasy, my father explained, of course, this is an area that a dog never gets easily to scratch. It just can't reach there. There's no way you can rub it against a tree. And I have to say that when I greet dogs during my consultations, you know, from time to time, I will scratch in that armpit area because they do melt. There's sort of awareness, this connection of, well, thanks for doing that. That's great. You know, they're really appreciative of this.
This is somebody I can like.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a really telling moment. And it was, you know, my father has absolutely no veterinary or medical training or, you know, in his past. It was just, it seemed intuitive to him, and it got the response he wanted in his dog. And I've been able to make use of that lesson.
Sure. And, of course, he was clearly very, very attentive to Patch.
Yeah.
And really could detect a special pleasure that Patch had in those moments. Patch was, at least to some extent, purchased because you didn't live in the best of neighborhoods. And this big German Shepherd was, you know, a formidable dog. And you describe a really interesting moment when you are being harassed by a couple of neighborhood bullies, nicknamed Carrot and the Slouch, and their attempted harassment of you ends thanks to Patch.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I used to be in the Scouts, or at that age in the Cub Scouts, and as I said, you know, in that era, parents didn't come and pick you up or carpool, so you tended to walk home from meetings, and it was late at night, and these two kids who were known to me through the school system were older, and they smoked, and, you know, they were notorious bullies in the neighborhood, and the neighborhood itself was not exactly a particularly safe area of the city. But they were stopping me just as I was about to enter the backyard, and we had two very large white gates that were holding holding our dog back to some extent, and Patch, with his booming bark, tuned in to the fact that I was nearby, and the kids were, of course, not to be fearful of a barking dog, until this dog exploded at the gate and just scared the living daylights out of them. And in doing so, I had that wonderful opportunity to slip on the inside of the fence and be affectionate to this guardian of Hades, and, you know, in their eyes, and yet here was me, a little wimpy kid, who could interact with this dangerous creature. And you know, that was one of the reasons that the dog was there. Unfortunately, it was to be protective, and like so many German Shepherds, you know, they have that instinct to look after those they love.
Right. You're right. I wondered if Carrot and the Slouch were still out there somewhere watching me interact with the beast that had frightened them enough to make them run away. I hoped so. I hoped they could see how I may have been smaller than them, but I was completely at ease around this intimidating creature. And looking back, This was a huge part of Patch's legacy for me. I may not have been his alpha dog, but I was a member of his pack. And so we still got to spend a good deal of time together. It was this kind of effortless accrual of time, doing nothing in particular, simply sharing each other's presence, that let me feel the aura of dog. We're talking with Dr. Nick Trout about his wonderful memoir, Ever by My Side. In the next chapter, which you called Blessings in Childhood Time, which in part is about when your parents moved, you say something really intriguing at one point that I'd love to have you expound upon a bit. You write, "For some people, when it comes to their dogs, there's a fine line between devotion, and raison d'être."
Yeah.
I wonder if you could just speak a word about that. I don't even recall now at the moment why that line comes up in this particular chapter, but whatever its context, I'm fascinated by the point you're making.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I think in my job as a, you know, I see referral surgical cases. So I see people who have really already, they've been to their regular veterinarian, they're coming to me on another level. They have already said, this animal, cat, dog, whatever, is so important to me, I need to help this animal's health. And so my father, I was always struck by the fact that he was sort of walking this fence between devotion and obsession with Patch, that he obviously, like any good dog owner, had felt his responsibility was to, you know, provide shelter and food and water and adequate exercise. But there was becoming this sort of reason to be, this sense that this dog was providing this man with time well spent. Their walks together were these moments of reflection, of enjoyment, of where our place is in the world and in our lives. You know, chance to think about family. You know, good things. And I think, you know, that there is that sort of sliding scale of where, you know, it's like a runner needs to run because they need that endorphin kick. And that Patch and that relationship was my father's endorphin. And it becomes this sort of sliding scale between devotion and obsession.
Hmm. In a previous chapter, you write, "Understandably, my father savored this unique bond," that is, this bond between he and Patch, "a relationship with a kindred spirit so different from anything else in his life."
Yeah.
There is a point when you begin to think seriously about becoming a veterinarian. And I don't know how much of this had to do with it. It roughly corresponds to when Patch begins to have some of his first health problems.
Right.
And this incredibly formidable dog starts to seem very, very fragile. But at any rate, your father is very taken with this notion that you might possibly become a veterinarian someday. Tell our listeners about his sort of full-scale attempt to encourage you along those lines. I mean, probably a campaign which in many other cases might have backfired.
Right. Well, you know, I wrote about this first day of going to a veterinary practice and tell me where it hurts. And, you know, at the end of that day, I let slip my enthusiasm for this profession. I was just, wow, this is fabulous. And that was the green light for my father. He, within a very short period of time, I mean, no more than a few weeks, became absolutely obsessed with James Herriot, to the point that he would, when he went on his walks, he would always wear a flat cloth cap in the manner of a Yorkshire farmer. He would walk with a walking stick. He would have copies of James Herriot's various books littered around the house. And finding that his son was not paying sufficient attention, he started to try to draw me into the BBC TV series All Creatures Great and Small. He also, when he watched this show, was entranced. He'd seen the episode so many times, he could speak verbatim on every meaningful exchange that he could recite it as though this were like a church service. And he then took this to the next level, which was to start speaking with a Yorkshire accent. My father actually was originally from Salisbury, Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, and lived in the center of England for most of his life. And this obviously was a more northern James Herriot type accent that he started to inject into everything he did and said. And he then went even another stage further to ultimately buy a home, a small cottage, right in the heart of Herriot country. And that's where he lives to this day. They live right in the middle of Wensleydale. And so this was not a passing phase. This was not a fad. And I think, you know, that was another aspect of what I was trying to get over in the book, is the fact that he had this image of his son leading a James Herriot lifestyle. And I always felt like my career took me in a different direction. It led me ultimately towards specialization in surgery and obviously in the United States, not England. And part of what I was getting across is our relationship and how I've always wanted to sort of make up for the time and space between us and my best attempts to do that.
Hmm. Your parents eventually get a second dog, Bess, a black lab with something else mixed in.
Right.
You make an interesting observation, or you quote somebody else making an interesting observation about this. I think it was a vet with whom you initially studied, Ryan James, who said, "One good thing going for a Heinz 57 is the benefit of hybrid vigor."
Right.
He said, "Hopefully Bess will have all the good breed traits and dodge all the bad. Part of the fun of having a mix is not knowing exactly what you're going to get."
Right.
I've never stopped to think about that positive aspect of getting a mixed breed is a mutt.
Yeah, I mean, I think when, you know, some people are very set on a specific type of dog. They want a terrier, they want a spaniel, they want a retriever. And so, you know, thankfully with people having increased interest in rescuing abandoned animals, animals in shelters, you know, you'll see these puppies, and it will be tough to have a sense of exactly what you're getting into. You know, they may be, you know, 7-8 weeks of age, and you're guessing that they're going to be 25 pounds as an adult, and they turn out to be 60, or you know, that you thought the dog was primarily a Doberman and turned out to be a miniature pincher, or, you know, there's so many differences that can occur. And, you know, there's some joy in that, and also the fact that, as I mentioned there in that passage, that hopefully you do get the goods and not so much of the bads. Mm. And that's part of what you accept when you take on that kind of dog.
Your family also gets a golden retriever named Whiskey, who experiences some fairly serious problem, but thankfully survives it. And in this encounter where the dog there's some fear that Whiskey won't make it through, and does in fact. And as your father is there to pick him up from, again, Dr. James, he says, "There's one thing for sure about this new dog of yours. He's a lion-hearted little fellow." Mm-hmm. No two ways about it. And as Dad pumped Ryan's hand, I witnessed a mixture of gratitude and pride welling up in my father's eyes, triggered by the shock of what his dog had become and by the fitting label, lion-hearted little fellow. Here, for the first time in this moment, it seemed all so personal, this business of healing pets, the way veterinary medicine can have such a profound effect on both humans and animals. Naturally, hanging out with James, I had observed the response of countless grateful owners, but here, with everything so close, with my dad and Ryan James, it was as if I could straddle both sides of the doctor-patient relationship, breathe in the sense of accomplishment, the power of what James had done, completely tangible and within reach. It was awesome. I just stood there speechless and ate it up. Love that passage, and I can really imagine that this only fueled your intense desire to become some sort of veterinarian.
Right.
Ultimately, you are drawn to the United States in a move which is not entirely easy, and quite apart from the significant matter of leaving behind your mom and dad and all that was familiar to you. Tell us a little bit about what was challenging about this move to America.
Well, you know, that it's, you know, I've always been thrilled by the way that Americans embrace the English, and you know, could not have been friendlier. The big problem was the fact that I was oblivious to and had no history of American culture. I just, you know, people in conversation take things for granted. I joke about the fact that I have no idea what a ding-dong is. I never knew what happened at Kent State. I didn't know who Walter Cronkite was or Saturday Night Live. You know, things that just form this background noise that Americans take for granted in conversation, yet when it's thrown out at me, I have nothing to say. I don't know. You're talking a foreign language. People to this day enjoy sitting down with me with a game of American football or baseball because I'm still not very familiar with what's going on. And it was, you know, brought home to me when I was invited to join some colleagues to shoot some hoops, trying to use the local jargon. And I just couldn't do this. I just thought, oh, I'll just step up with a basketball and I'll be able to dunk with the best of them. And these kind of differences are things that, you know, on a previous visit to the United States, I was never really aware of. I just got this little hint of American culture, and suddenly I was being, you know, submerged in it.
Mm-hmm. On top of that, you found that many pet owners in America seem to walk into the office of the vet with a slightly different attitude, an attitude which you say I would eventually grow to love, edgy, persistent, dedicated, and educated.
Right. And that still holds true. I mean, I think I was, you know, I was, this was 1991, and I was only had graduated a couple of years before. But, you know, suddenly I am having to justify everything that I'm thinking, that I'm doing. When I was practicing in the UK, you know, you just say, okay, I'm going to give your dog these antibiotics and you know, run the course of treatment and your dog should be fine. Whereas suddenly I was being presented with people would say, well, why are you doing that? You know, which antibiotic and why, what's your basis for that? And this was a wake-up call to me that these are fine questions. These are questions I've already asked myself, but I haven't aired those questions to the client. And suddenly you realize that the quality communication really lies at the heart of any healthcare, be it human or animal. That if we understand one another, if we are both trying to go in the same direction for the same goal, that you know, things will be much better between us. And now it's become the norm for me. Mm. And I think, you know, that's definitely the best way to go. I mean, you get into far, you know, you will never be the perfect veterinarian for every client, but by airing your thoughts and at least having a thorough exchange of ideas, you can find out whether you can work together or not.
Mm. You call it learning to appreciate the art of clinical justification.
Yeah.
Eventually, you marry a woman you fell in love with very quickly. You have a happy life. with children, but happiness that is interrupted when your daughter, is it Emily?
Yep.
Is diagnosed with cystic fibrosis.
Right.
One of the things you say is that this very harsh, sad reality changed the way you looked at your work as a veterinarian. You write at one point, I could feel esteem for my vocation slipping away from me. I had begun to devalue my profession, driven by the fear of losing a priceless and irreplaceable child. I questioned the comparative merits and worth of an animal. And of course, then the worth of caring for animals would sort of suffer by comparison as well.
Right.
Share at least a bit of the story of a golden retriever named Gracie, because this made such a huge difference in reestablishing your devotion to your vocation.
Yeah, this was a dog, golden retriever, who was brought in by a woman who had a son, a teenage boy, who'd done something stupid in that he'd been riding around in the back of a pickup truck and got thrown out and suffered severe head trauma. And Gracie was his dog, and Gracie needed surgery to correct a chest trauma, a hernia. And the mother and I, at that moment, you know, I was struggling with coming to terms with my daughter's diagnosis, and why don't I just become a human MD or go into research or do something to actually help my daughter? And the mother confided in me that, you know, this, you know, if you can save the dog, we can save the boy. That she didn't want to place this horrible amount of pressure on me, but she wanted to let me see that this is my reality, and that she also exuded this aura of no one knows what's going to happen to any of us. You know, we don't know what's around the corner, the accidents that can happen, the illness that could come our way. And so you cannot live your life saying goodbye to your child. And she wasn't prepared to do that for her son. She knew this, that her son was in seriously bad way. But if she just exuded this aura of my kid's a lost cause, what purpose did that serve? And that really hit home to me, because I said to myself, you know, this child of mine, this little girl of 2.5 years old, does not need a father who goes off to medical school or starts to think about becoming a research scientist for cystic fibrosis. She needs a father who's a father. She needs someone in her life. She wants to build memories and enjoy as much time as she possibly has. And so with that in mind, I went set about trying to fix this dog, Gracie, and things did not go easily, but ultimately was successful. And you know, as I say at the end of that chapter, I don't know exactly what happened to this woman's son and whether he recovered. All I know is that I got to play my little part, that I could say that I did make a difference for a person by helping an animal.
Nick Trout, Dr. Nick Trout, the author of this marvelous memoir, which is called Ever By My Side, a memoir in 8 pets. The book is published by Broadway Books. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I look forward to welcoming into our studios Brian Albrecht, who is the president of Gateway Technical College, paying his monthly visit to the program. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Our weather forecast is for sunshine this morning, giving way to increasing clouds, and we could see about an inch or so of snow this afternoon with a high of 19 degrees. Cloudy and cold overnight, a low of 17, not nearly as cold as last night was. And actually, tomorrow, Thursday, under cloudy skies, we'll have a balmy high of 36 degrees. Friday, a 50% chance of light rain or snow, and warming to 39. A little colder, though, later in the weekend. This is W.